never gets fat.
Hello, and welcome to the Saladcast on Monday, the 6th of October, 2025. I'm your host, Dan Train. Joining me today is Zachary Burgess.
With a PH.
And Robert Kemp.
With a slug. Fat slug.
Fat with a slug.
That was also with a PH, though, wasn't it?
There was a PH, yeah.
What was fat slug?
That was like the big green RC car from Revolt.
The most terrible car in Revolt.
Of course, the green one.
Fat slug. Don't know what made it so, like, pH fat.
That didn't look much like a slug. So it was probably more fat than a slug.
It was a bit sluggish, right? Because it was just sort of like a one sort of lump body. It didn't, like, have the normal sort of, like, wheel arch or cockpit sort of design. It was kind of just a...
It was quite bulbous, though, for a slug. Yeah.
Yeah, it was bulbous, but it still had, like, the wheels were pretty big and stick outside. It wasn't like it was, like, a literal just, like, a hemisphere driving around.
I have not heard the word fat with pH much around recently.
How would you know?
I suppose because it's a homophone. How would you know?
I did hear it pretty recently, but I can't remember the context. I think I might have been listening to old episodes of 60 Songs That Explain the 90s or...
Oh, that's a good podcast.
It is a good podcast.
That guy talks in such a strange way where he like obviously he's written it, right? But maybe he talks in the same way like when he's talking normally. But basically he stops in the middle of the sentence and then continues the sentence. It runs immediately into the next one and he pauses in the middle of that sentence.
Yeah.
And it's very odd.
And then or sometimes stops and goes off on a half hour tangent.
Amazing. Recommend that podcast.
It's very good. Yeah,
he really knows what he's talking about. That guy.
Oh, absolutely.
Journalist. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was just listening to the Tupac episode, and it's like that's a. Yeah, I don't know. I think the guy who is interviewing. I'm not necessarily so keen on the interview segment at the second half of those podcasts.
Often skip those. Yeah.
But yeah, frequently. But like this guy was all right talking about the Tupac thing. That was kind of funny. But yeah, I'm pretty sure the word fat was mentioned there at some point, in some capacity.
The annoying thing about, because I often have that with like American late night shows, I'll be like, I'll watch the monologue, and as soon as they get to the interview, I'm like, nope, don't care, or whatever, skip over that.
Sure,
but with that show in particular, because it's a podcast on Spotify, it takes the best possible advantage of being on Spotify by immediately playing the full track on Spotify afterwards, right?
Yeah, they broke that at one point and it stopped working.
No.
But
that was cool.
But it's working again now, I noticed.
Oh, that's
good. For a while it stopped, but it seems to be back.
And that's really cool, but it's slightly annoying trying to skip the interview and get to the track.
Yeah.
If you want to skip the interview.
Especially sometimes, like, when
on purpose.
Not super familiar with the song sometimes and on there. And they'll, because it's, I guess it's from an American slant, right? There are some on there that just weren't really big over here.
Yeah, that's true. Although he does cover ones that are bigger, were big in the UK.
Yeah, he does as well.
Less so in America, which is nice.
Definitely splits interest. Which is good.
Have you listened to Song Exploder? Is a good podcast, which is where
I haven't. No, I'm aware of it because they did a show of it as well. I think.
Oh, yeah, it's a Netflix show. I haven't actually seen that.
It's
a podcast by original format, but that's where they get the actual artist on to break down the track or whatever.
Yeah.
How it was made and stuff. And that can be quite good, although it's very dependent on the artist.
Oh, I bet.
More so, I would say.
And how much they were actually involved or something like that. You know, you can never tell. It's like, I think I saw, wasn't it like the opener of Song Exploder is like Dua Lipa or something? Or the show, anyway.
Oh, the TV show.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, I seem to remember her being on the marketing graphics. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, she's quite an interesting character, but like, I'm not quite sure how much she necessarily writes the songs. You never really know, I guess. But maybe this would highlight that. And for me, the production is just as interesting. And I bet she wasn't too involved in that. But like, I don't know.
I haven't watched that show, but there is definitely a podcast episode of her talking about one of her songs in Sonic Exploder. And that is literally how I know that how involved she is in writing her own songs or whatever.
Okay.
That was quite good. That made me more interested in her than I ever was before, honestly.
Cool.
Well, so it's a good format, I think. Because she talked about how she deliberately not played up, but like emphasized her British accent in part of that verse about dancing your ass off or whatever.
Right.
Like, or whatever. And she's like, I just sound generic. I don't sound like, well, I sound neutral. I don't sound British much on when I'm singing. And I wanted
a lot of people don't, right? Like everyone, yeah. Like most people like adopt an American way of singing, right?
Yeah.
Which is sometimes annoying.
That was kind of cool. That was deliberate.
Nice.
Anyway. Yeah, that's a good one. Podcasts. Like this one. We don't really often talk for a podcast. We don't often talk about podcasts because we talk about video games mostly.
And to be honest, I don't really listen to many podcasts other than this Giant Bomb, occasionally Easy Allies. Oh, I've been listening quite a bit more to the Digital Foundry Direct listening to their stuff. It can be a bit like,
bit much
over technical for me, you know, for yeah. But like that's what they do, so that's fine. Like it is what it is. Like I don't, and they say that phrase a lot. It is what it is. Well, what can I say? I'm moving. Yeah, like favorite. he's got an awful lot of Richard Ledbetter's got an awful lot of mannerisms or like repeated phrases when they like it's just what can I say to almost everything. Like
little accidental catchphrases.
Yeah,
it's good.
But yeah, some of the techie stuff is a bit. It's not really background listening.
Right, yeah, because you just sort of drift and then you've lost the thread of what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Some kind of weird, machine learning, the anti-aliasing technique or something.
Well, was it the advanced shader delivery or something system, which some people seem to be talking about to try and solve stutter struggle on PC?
All very interesting.
And Oliver does say cromulent quite a lot on that podcast.
That should be used sparingly, I think.
No, yeah, there's every episode, there's at least one cromulent drop, but like but they don't even bat an eyelid at it now. It's not even a joke to them. It's just like,
I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly cromulent. Don't overdo it. Speaking of Spotify, have you seen that they finally launched Lossless? Oh my god!
I did, yeah, and then immediately saw some YouTube thumbnail saying it's not very good. But
yeah, that one bloke who is a strange-looking bloke. He looks like the kind of guy who reviews headphones professionally on YouTube. The guy, who that guy is. But I think it was basically, I did watch that. It was probably the same video, and. But it did make me change my settings on my Mac OS. But like, you can line up, right, your audio output to the same frequency as the actual file or whatever.
Oh, I see.
And the bitrate as well.
Gotcha.
You can change that in Windows, but I found I can change it in Mac as well with a different thing. But it's like 44/100 kilohertz and 24 bit or something like that.
Yeah,
mine was set to 48k and 16. Or no,
that's always sort of weirdly surprised me that 44/1 is still the musical thing. Yet somehow every now and then I get poked. Like I ran into some trouble with FL Studio the other day that started getting a bit crashy and a bit unpredictable on me. And so I reached out to FL support and they were like, yeah, try these settings. And they were like in 48K mode and I think they were only using like 16-point integer or something.
Exactly.
Rather than like float sound, which I thought, like, shouldn't we be on like 32-bit float audio now? Not, I don't know. I don't actually know what is the better format on that front. But it just sort of surprised me. And I submitted some music to something once and it's like, no, and I couldn't work out why it wasn't uploading. And it's like, because I output it all in 48K and they wanted 44.1. And it's like, oh, okay. I didn't know that's what you needed.
I've been trying that because obviously it adds that it means that if anything that's not matching, which I think majority of stuff is 48, that, you know,
But I don't know that that's true. It's strange. Maybe game audio is mixed to 48. Like, 48, I have no idea. Like, you're never really told what settings you should have.
But at least in the Spotify thing, it does say when you select Lossless, this is FLAC and this is 44/1 24-bit integer. So you
interesting.
Match,
yeah,
you know,
cool.
If you wanted to avoid it,
to really audiophile it.
Yeah, I mean, not that it really matters, but I mean, if I mean. if you're trying to get closer. I don't think that's what that video was basically saying, is you actually can't get fully to lossless because you can't get the software to talk directly to the audio interface. It always goes through the operating system.
Right. It's not using ASIO. It's using Windows audio.
And there's no option to do that, which maybe that'll come. But I mean, it took 10 years or something for lossless to arrive. So
right, 10 years. I wonder if that's true on is that only true on Windows at the moment then? Or the Mac client that you get these, that lossless is available, or is it on mobile as well? Or
it's on mobile as well. Hmm. It's on all platforms, I think.
Yeah, well, so I wonder if they have an OS problem there as well.
Yeah, on the mobile devices and stuff. Mm. Yeah, I think they do.
Because I bet you can't change any of those settings there.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not audiophile enough to get, I suppose the point
is, it's really
is
hard
that,
to notice, in fairness. But yeah, no. I can understand it. The sampling, it's one of those awkward sets of numbers, right? 44, 1, 48. It's like it will be in the high end, but it's like, it is a sampling difference. Something is going to be wrong.
But it's like, why resample if you can avoid it?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I've changed mine to line up with Spotify because that's where I care about audio quality the most on my system.
Yeah,
I don't really care if it's resampling YouTube videos, but if it's not when I'm trying to listen to songs at nice in my hi-fi thing.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, I've definitely shifted my whole environment to 44.1 now. So it's,
same. Yeah. So that was the one benefit of watching that video of that guy being nitpicking.
Yeah. All right, cool. Good to know. I might have to make sure I turn that on. See if I bet I can't tell a difference.
Yeah, it's quite hard to tell.
Yeah. But they got there. Wasn't it Tidal? Was that the first one to actually sort of be like, this is our whole deal?
It is and was. I think Tidal supports high whatever audio, that weird format, the beyond CD format. What's it called? High something audio as well.
Super audio.
Yeah. I think it supports super audio. I think all the competitors like Apple Music have offered standard lossless for ages. Mm. So it was Spotify was lagging quite a lot. It's the only, I don't care about AI DJs and shit. Just give me the lossless audio. And they finally have.
Well, I suppose that's quite an annoying endeavor for them. Maybe it was irritating from the fact that maybe they didn't have the original uploads in some cases, right? Because maybe they got converted to what they needed and then they'd never kept the WAVs.
I think they probably had everything. Yeah. It was just a pain to get things into that format. Because as far as I can tell, it has a little label on it when you're playing lossless. And as far as I can tell, everything that I've played has been available in lossless.
Cool.
So at least now they've rolled it out, it actually is.
Yeah, maybe they had to get to a certain amount of stuff on their CMS that was in that format.
Exactly.
Before they launched it. Yeah, it must have been harder to do it now than earlier, right? They've got
so much gets uploaded every day, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, there's Glacial Spoon on there, so,
Listen to some Glacial Spoon.
Woo! Just mildly video game adjacent. I mentioned Digital Foundry. This is a podcast about video games.
It is indeed.
But before that, I watched The Thursday Murder Club. That's my film
of the week.
Yeah. It is fine.
Fine.
I wouldn't say it's hugely.
Is this in cinemas or is it just
I don't know. I think it is a Netflix joint, but I don't know if it had a theatrical release. Alongside it, but
much money has Richard Osman made?
megabucks, presumably. but it's quite the cast in this thing. Like Helen Mirren, Richard E. Grant, Piers Brosnan,
Bronholm,
yeah. What's his face? The Mandarin. It's
Ben Kingsley.
Yeah. So it's quite a good cast, but. I don't know. And as big as the book series is and as popular as it's been, it felt like the film was just quite run of the mill. It's a very sort of not super surprising whodunit. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I think it needed something else. It wasn't particularly gritty. It wasn't necessarily as funny as Glass Onion or as quirky as films like that. You know, it felt like it was missing something. It's almost like the recent Kenneth Branagh Poirot's, right? They're fine, but I felt like they weren't necessarily, it felt like they were just missing an edge of some description. And this kind of falls into that same pattern for me.
I guess it's quite safe and cozy.
Yeah, it definitely is. If that's what you want, it is definitely that. And like, I've got no beef with it in that respect. Like, if you just want a cozy watch, this is exactly that.
It's weird because like the archetypical of this stuff is obviously all the Agatha Christie stuff, and like Poirot, like you're saying, but like Agatha Christie is like, you know, supposedly cozy, but not actually cozy.
Not actually, like, though. No.
At least certainly some of them are pretty, yeah. Yeah. Although I like there is a certain coziness to some of the adaptations, like what's the ITV one? What's his name? Suchet, David Suchet.
Oh, yeah.
For example, yeah. I think I saw an adaptation with John Malkovich that was like a BBC TV thing or something, and it was well bad.
No, really?
He's not a good...
Wait, John Malkovich was Poirot. I can't even say it. Poirot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It was an adaptation of the ABC Murders, which is like one of the best ones. 2018. Oh, God.
Wow, okay. Anyway, that's way more recent than I thought.
It was not good, in my opinion.
Huh. I never heard of that.
Yeah. It's David Suchet or like...
I mean, Suchet's a legend, yeah.
Who plays him in... is it different people in the films, like Murder on the Nile and...
No, I think it's been Kenneth Branagh each time. In the newer ones.
The 70s ones.
No, I haven't seen those.
Well, they're pretty good. I mean, that's what that kind of emphasizes. Like, I'm sure the Branagh ones are good, but they're following up some... good early adaptations. I guess the Thursday Murder Club doesn't have to contend with that.
There was a Suchet version of Death on the Nile, I think. I think I've seen that.
Yeah, I think there was. But that one is, the 70s one of that is really good.
Hmm.
Yeah. Is it Faye Dunaway in that?
No, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Peter Ustinov, that's right, who did... oh, it's Mia Farrow, sorry. Anyway, doesn't matter. And Maggie Smith's in it.
No, of course.
Classic.
Yeah,
anyway, so Thursday Murders.
Yeah, it's all right. It's just all right.
Are they making more Knives Out stuff for Christmas, and are they going to do even more of that?
I don't know. I quite like more Knives Out. I did enjoy those first two films. I mean, the first one's way better than the second, but I do like Benoit Blanc as a character.
That's the guy.
Especially Daniel Craig's slightly quirky take on it. It was pretty good. I enjoyed those.
There is indeed a new one coming.
I think I'm in a bit of a whodunit mood at the moment after watching The Residents and stuff like that. It's like there's yeah, should be some, but not in the. Oh, I need a good TV show that's like that, but you know, lighthearted, not The Wire. You know,
right? Okay, fair. Have you seen The Wire?
No, I never actually did. Like, it was kind of on my like I wouldn't mind watching it kind of thing, but like I just never got around to it. Like, I haven't finished Department Q, like, because of the Milesy problem, right? We can't watch it in front of.
Yeah, fair enough.
So that's a bit too hard.
Maybe don't watch The Wire in front of my...
Yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe the Simpsons movie. Or the new Simpsons movie.
Oh, what on earth will that be like?
I have not heard, I've only heard clips, but like Marge's voice is just totally wrecked, isn't it, at this point?
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because it was always, you know, imagine having to do that voice, because it was obviously a put-on gravelly voice, I guess, always from the beginning, right? Mm. in the 90s or no 80s. So yeah, I think it's starting to sound.
I'm amazed it's still most of the original cast, in fairness.
Yeah, a few of them have retired or passed.
Yeah,
when will they end it, or when will they bring in AI to fix the voices, which would be bad.
Oh boy, yeah, I bet they'll try.
It's very tempting.
Yeah. They've got it's got so much to learn from.
Yeah, it would probably sound quite good.
Yeah, it would have to be. It's getting better, but there's always certain tells, isn't there? Still about AI audio, it's not quite right still, but it's pretty good. Like I saw an article the other day about someone. I think it might have been on Kotaku actually. Like someone talking about the Vodafone did some influencer ads, shall we say, but they were AI generated, but they were really convincing. Like it's got to be like, and I would sort of somewhat like, you know, they were talking about how they thought something was off, so they quizzed Vodafone about it, and they were like, yeah, we're experimenting with a few things, yeah. And I'm watching this clip going, wow, it is actually legitimately incredibly hard to tell that this isn't right. Slightly terrifying.
Slightly very terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Somewhat boo to it. However, progress has been made, as you showed me. Yes. Knuckles can now be pictured in a potato shop liking what he sees.
He actually looked like he liked what he saw.
He liked what he saw. He was very happy about those potatoes.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast before, but like, this is just a running joke between us about putting Knuckles in a potato shop and then ending the prompt with he likes what he sees and seeing what it comes up with. And he's never been happy up until now.
I have noticed on YouTube, like generic YouTube adverts or whatever, that are obviously all starting to use AI now. Like, it's, and also thumbnails, because a lot of people are doing that because they're lazy. Like, it seems like, I don't know if it's a prompting thing or whether it is just literally the models, but they've all sort of coagulated into one specific cartoon style that's like a cross between Simpsons and Ghibli.
Yeah,
That's
the OpenAI model does that. So literally what I just did, like I gave it the prompt, our standard prompt, listeners, which is, yes, Knuckles from Sonic the Hedgehog in a potato shop. He likes what he sees. but of course it used that style because it seems to be its default. That like weird.
Oh, really? It picks that first?
Yeah, first. So I had to add a sentence saying, you know, make it like the live action Sonic the Hedgehog movies.
Yeah, I don't like it. It must is that, do you think that's just that the model has drifted to that as its default, or do you think that's an actual back end prompt to try and avoid more copyright problems?
Well, surely they're creating a copyright problem because Ghibli is like himself, and you know, the studio Ghibli and Miyazaki and all that stuff, they are super unhappy like that GPT and services like this actually push that as kind of their cartoon mode.
Didn't like, stop the US government.
Well, nothing stops them.
Yep.
Apparently not.
Yeah, I don't know, because obviously the models don't actually learn in real time, right? Like, obviously.
No, they have to.
You train them offline and then they put out new models that, yeah. But surely that can't be that far away that they're training themselves continuously, so you don't have to be like, okay, this is GPT-5 now.
The singularity.
Unless the companies have decided not to risk like the AI corrupting itself thing going on. Just have it like, let's just keep it locked for now.
Well, I think that's the thing. Yeah, right now that is the problem, right? AI can't tell what is AI. And that then that we already know that is a problem. If AI trains also, on AI, it gets bad very quickly.
And also some amount of like all those things where people have been trying to create AI poison things to put on your files to right, just yeah. like, if the AI scans this, it will fuck it up some more.
Yeah.
More for it.
I mean,
did
if it
you
gets
see
us back to
stories about like when the because you know they released a new model that is better at reasoning, right? But it's also better in the sense that it's less sycophantic. I think the OpenAI AI model, and a lot of people were very upset that they're like the AI model they were basically in a relationship with was suddenly became all cold and
right, yeah,
just not the same. Like, no, it's not the same.
It sort of quickly outdated the all those comic books that like oh when our robot overlords take over, it's like you shall be put to the oh no wait no you were polite to Copilot, that's fine,
yeah.
you can stay alive, it's okay. But yeah ChatGPT doesn't go into all so much of the like oh what a wonderful question. What a sharp
yeah,
eye you've got
did. So annoying.
Good critical thinking, Rob.
Yeah. God damn it.
I mean, I don't mind any of that stuff. I quite like Copilot's output, but it's more on that later, I guess.
Okay, let's get to it later. But first, the news in video games. Not necessarily in AI, but I'm sure that will be part of it.
The news! All right, yeah, quite a lot has happened in the last two weeks.
Things.
Well, I say quite a lot, but yeah some big stuff. Tokyo Game Show happened, and while I haven't got a huge amount to it's not been a huge place for announcements, really, of like Tokyo Game, IGG, you know, the studio behind Like a Dragon and Yakuza, they did their own sort of little direct-y type thing. To coincide with TGS, and of course we got a game announcement because you know we can't have a year without RGG releasing something. So Yakuza Kiwami 3 is a thing; they've getting round to it, which is great news. That's kind of cool. It looks like there's a bunch of stuff they're bringing into Yakuza 3 from the more recent games. For some reason, there seems to be like a weird retro segue in there. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work in the timeline. Or maybe it does. Maybe segues were about in the timeline of Yakuza 3. I can't really remember. But yeah,
you mean the personal transportation vehicle?
I do mean the personal transportation vehicle, yes.
Not the way that you move between topics.
No, not that form of segue. Although, are there really that many segues in... Is a segue necessarily a thing in Japanese? I don't know. I'm not even sure. But anyway, yeah, so that's cool. But they're not only are they giving Yakuza 3 the Kiwami treatment, they are adding a side story about some spoilers, I guess, the bad guy one of the bad guys from Yakuza 3. In this thing they're calling Dark Ties. Now, I immediately assumed that was a spin-off game when I first heard it, but no, Yakuza 3 and Dark Ties is Yakuza Kiwami 3 and Dark Ties is how they're selling this. It's like it's a package deal. So yeah, getting Kiwami 3 and brand new content and a brand new story. Pretty cool news.
Nice. When are you going to get to that? 2030?
Yeah, for me, absolutely miles away. But okay. Yeah, it's a February release, so not that far away. But yeah, well, that means we've already got an RGG game on the cards for 2026. We still don't. I don't know if they've told us when. I forgot what the game's real name is called, but it was Project Sentry, but they gave it a proper name. It's like Stranger Than Something, Stranger Than Life or something. Anyway, whether that new title, that new IP is coming out in 2026. And also RGG are working on more Virtua Fighter, don't forget, as well. So they're a busy studio right now. So anyway, that's cool. I don't know if they were at TGS themselves, but Team Reptile had an announcement and that there's going to be a sequel to Bomb Rush Cyberpunk.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called Hyperfunk.
Now, that's a good name.
Hyperfunk.
I think I like that better than Bomb Rush Cyberpunk.
Oh, definitely. I think the whole Bomb Hyperfunk Rush thing is kind of, that's kind of a graffiti culture term or something. I think that was, you bomb the neighborhood or something like that is
right. It's a bomb. Okay, a bomb rush.
Something like that.
It felt like it was obviously trying to be three words like Jet Set Radio.
Yes, I think that's what they were going for. Whereas now they're just leading into the funk, which is fine.
Okay,
look at the funk.
Let's look at the funk.
Yeah, I mean they haven't shown us a lot, but what the footage they have shown, where it looks like the motion has been refined over the previous game, like even more so than it was before. It's I'm just kind of looking for a slightly more seamless experience, a little more of my only real complaint with Bomb Rush Cyberpunk was that it didn't necessarily go as far as Jet Set Radio Future did in or even the first Jet Set Radio in having its style, if you know what I mean. It felt in its own weird way, Bomb Rush Cyberpunk was that little bit more subdued, not quite firing as many cylinders as Jet Set Radio does, and I really hope this is the thing they need to solve. It's a little bit. I'm hoping for the same sort of transition that we got from Lethal League, right? Lethal League was a great game, but Lethal League Blaze was like, oh boy, yeah, they found the juice in Blaze. Right. So
this time they're really going to understand the concept, right?
Oh yeah, they understand the concept of love, surely. exciting stuff. I'm hype.
Okay.
And Microsoft had an announcement that they announced where Forza Horizon 6 is going to be. In Japan.
Ooh.
So of course they'd say that at TGS. And it's like, I think that's a pretty cool pretty cool place to do it. Like, I think it's cool.
Style mountain roads.
Well,
that would be good.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool because I somewhat hope that it actually means that the game won't be as open as the Horizon series has lent in, well, pretty much all of its entries since 3, I guess.
Right, Mexico's like, very open, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I kind of, I'm not 100% I really like the you know, where Horizon has gone or has been leaning into, like the whole, like I'm when I've been playing Forza Horizon 4 most recently, and I've been like, you know, you run into cobblestone walls or something that does nothing to your car. You know what I mean? I want a little bit more of, like, I can't just drive through fences and it do nothing to me. Like, I don't know. I think
this isn't the classic, like, licenses won't permit car body damage thing.
I mean, it could well be. It could be a part of that. But then it creates this, like, almost burnout style, this does nothing or it does everything approach to collisions. And it can sometimes be challenging to know which is which, right? It's like, oh, I can drive through that tree, but not that tree.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I just don't, I'm not sure, I'm not really into just driving over open fields anyway. That's not really what I want.
Curvy roads.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm hoping the Japan entry, like famous for its mountain roads and like toge courses and stuff like that, will be more constrained in that way. And I think that's a good thing. I bet there'll be a rice field to jump over somewhere, but like,
I'm sure.
I don't know. Constrain yourselves, guys, and I think
avoid the like big, because Tokyo's so huge, you can't really convincingly. Well,
they have said it will feature the biggest city they've ever put in a Forza Horizon game. They have said that much. So
it could be another city, I guess.
Yeah, it could be something else.
Tokyo's got the expressways that are so iconic, right?
Right.
The
exactly.
Whole games are inspired by them.
Exactly. Yeah, like you've got to have the highways. You've got to have the Tokyo Extreme Racer homage.
Yeah, you can't just have it be Kyoto because it doesn't have the same car culture, you know.
Exactly. Well, I really hope they look to games like Ridge Racer and things like that and be like, well, okay, if we're sort of going to theme this on Japan. You know, they're never really strict about roads being like real roads, but like, you know, I hope they take their inspiration for track design and things like that from games like that. And it's,
I'm kind of excited to actually, I might actually play this one. I'm not that, even though the latest Mexico one, what's it, 5?
5, yeah.
Is now available on PlayStation 5. There's something about it that doesn't, I've seen you playing it, it doesn't appeal to me somehow.
Yeah, I mean,
but
it's,
I have a feeling Japan might.
I mean, what was the last one you played? Did you play 3 or did you stop it?
I haven't really played them.
Oh, right, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think they've all kind of been the same since 3 to me. 3, 4, and 5 are very similar. Like, 2, I guess, defined the current mold to an extent, but, like, 3, 4, and 5, like, feel the same. I'm hoping this is the bit of a shake-up that the series needs, and I hope there aren't so many of the annoying voiceover things, and I hope they don't call you superstar every other sentence. And like, there's a.
I wonder if it's just Japan the setting will help with that somehow.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Can I make all the voices Japanese? And in which case, does that make it considerably less annoying?
Yeah, like, that'd be good.
Yeah, I don't know. It has a Horizon just has a packaging problem for me, but and so hopefully they'll. I mean, they probably won't. Microsoft got a lot of problems at the moment, so we'll, I bet this will be the safest ass safe game they could chuck onto every platform imaginable, which, you know, it's a concern, but there's so much potential.
Okay. Well, I see why that was announced at DES.
Yeah. They also announced, like, that, you know, Flight Sim is getting another pass over. They'd already done a Japan pack. A while back, yeah, like where okay, they updated, yeah. But they're doing another pass over Japan to make it even right. Better than before.
And they're putting out on PlayStation 5, apparently.
And they are, yeah. Segue to the Sony State of Play, where, yeah, flights. I find it strange that Microsoft refer to it as Flight Sim 2024, even though it's kind of just an ongoing service now. Like they,
but there, it was like a refresh from 2020, right? 2024, that, I guess.
And has like it been that? Has the modern version been around that long? Like
2020, I think, was when it came out.
Oh, really? Huh.
And then 2024 was like the big enough refresh to call it a new... Okay, well, whatever.
A new package.
That means, yeah. New package, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Yeah, so it's coming out on PS5... soon, I think, as Flight Sim 2024. Yeah, so that's kind of cool. I mean, that game always looks great. Like, I don't know, I messed around with it for a bit, like a while ago, maybe in 2020. I don't know, I can't remember. Passage of time, what? But yeah, it did look. It always looks good whenever they show footage of it. It's just, I kind of. It's a pretty dull experience for me, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It makes aviation look cool.
Yeah.
We got to see a little bit more of Sauros, was kind of one of the big things here. Sauros is essentially Returnal 2. And I think this game looks pretty rad. I thought Returnal looked pretty rad, but there was something about it that kind of just, I don't know, sounded a little off-putting about it. I can't really put my finger on why, probably just because it's another roguelike to some extent. It's a, you know, bullet hell roguelike, but from third person. This kind of looks like more of that in its own way, but with, you know, different flavor, different styling. Don't know why this feels like it's appealing to me more, and I can't tell you why, but it's probably a good thing to, you know, take Housemark to take one of their most successful games and have another go at it, have another go at the formula. I think it looks cool. Deus Ex Remastered was revealed here.
Boy.
And the internet has opinions. Dan has opinions.
What a shame.
That's know. Far too much of an actual emotion to that version, though. You actually care about it. You've got to, if you're going with the original voice line, you've got to make it as emotionless as possible.
Okay, I was trying. It obviously wasn't deadpan enough.
No.
Daddy. What a shame. Yeah. I mean, just why did they show it by doing like showing the original graphics and then showing their new graphics? Obviously, that's what you want to do with a remaster.
Sure,
but it was like every time they do a wipe to the new graphics, it's like, ugh.
It's like there's not a huge amount of difference, like for one, no. on the surface of it. But like some of like all they've really done is like change the lighting model. That's the biggest thing they've done is change the lighting model primarily to something a bit more modern. But I actually. all I could really tell was that, okay, we've got light reflections in the floor and it's a lot darker now. Are those the primary improvements here?
But I also think it's possible to remaster this game. You'd have to remake it.
I think you're right. I think you'd have to go ground up and try and do it again.
You'd have to do like Black Mesa did for Half-Life. That's the idea.
Right, yeah. It doesn't necessarily feel like it works. It's like, I know studios have done, I think this one's done by Aspyr, who have done some good remasters before, but they're not like on the Night Dive level. Like this feels like a project that should have been given to someone like Night Dive that would have really honored what the original was like. But yeah, I don't know. It's just it's the character models for me that look the most odd. Like, because they haven't just relit them; they've retextured them and remodeled them to an extent. And people's faces just genuinely look different now. And it's like, that's a bit off-putting. What a weird thing. I wonder if no one's talked about if it plays good or not. Like, I haven't actually seen it. Like, is it out yet? Has anyone actually had a go at this? Like, maybe it still plays all right. Maybe a consolization is interesting in some ways.
I mean, I guess if this has a toggle so I can play like more original graphics, and I can play it with a gamepad, then I might consider getting it if it's cheap enough just to be able to play Deus Ex. You know, I don't know.
With a smaller RSI risk.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that.
Yes, what a strange thing. I didn't really pick out too much else from the Sony State of Play. It was kind of like, I don't know, sad. The tone of Sony just seems to be serious game for serious people, like all the time. There's like almost no whimsy in this, apart from this one thing that I thought looked kind of neat, and has a great name. It's called Chronoscript: The Endless End, and it's
that's a good name.
And it's another one of these like book traversal games. I guess we've seen a few recently where there's been games themed around moving from page to page in books, and this is another one of those. But it's a bit more. It's more of a Hollow Knight, I guess, in terms of how it plays. By the looks of it, it's got a very like brown sepia look to it. I guess all the books are old and things like that. I'm sure there'll be more to it than that at some point, but they're doing fun things with like spilled ink that you can swim in between pages, and the books themselves, the world around you sort of kind of changes, and thus the roots change as a result of that, like books falling off shelves and stuff like that. It looks pretty neat. Looks kind of cool, but we've had a few of those of late, so hopefully this stands out enough. And the last thing we got to see was a bit more of Insomniac's Wolverine. So I guess they're not working on a Spider-Man game right now. I'd kind of forgotten what they were up to, but they're working on Wolverine right now, and it's a pretty bloody looking hack and slash.
I mean, I suppose you might as well go all in if you're going to do Wolverine.
Yeah. It looks like it's going to be, like, because I guess it has to be different from Spider-Man in some ways. They're not, like, doing the one area thing here. They're doing lots of locales this time. It's not just New York. So I'm assuming the structure of the game is, I don't know what it will be. Like, is it going to be, like, an Uncharted-y, more of a sort of linear story thing? Or is it going to be semi-open world and you can return to areas and there's stuff to do and stuff like that? I don't actually really have a feel for what this game necessarily is right now. All I kind of know is it does kind of have that Insomniac look for how the action is, even though it is now considerably more adult, let's put it that way. As you might expect from Wolverine. But they've got a whole year to tell us more about it. It's not out till fall 2026. But hey, it's a big Insomniac game. It's probably going to be good. That's all I've really got from Sony. Doug Bowser has left Nintendo. There we go. Let's mention the Big Red at least once.
Okay.
He's been there 5 years. He's been at Nintendo 10 years total. I think everyone laughed when he turned up and said, "Hi, I'm Bowser. Yes, my name is Bowser." And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
That's all we've really known publicly about what he's been up to. He's actually retiring. He's not like being kicked out like by Nintendo or anything like that. It doesn't sound like he's being forced out or anything. So it's hard to say that Nintendo need another Reggie or something like that. It's like, but they kind of need another Reggie.
Yeah, they kind of do.
Disrespect to Nintendo of Japan and how they're like presenting their directs or anything like that. That stuff's fine, but there's no. There's no American face currently, really.
Yeah.
So I would understand it if they wanted someone who could run that show a little bit more. Someone they could make a puppet out of,
Yeah.
Someone whose body is ready.
Exactly.
Good luck to you, Bowser. Enjoy your retirement. Let's get to the big stories. EA has lost itself. I was about to say loses its damn mind, but it's kind of just lost itself. It hasn't technically sold yet, but it has made an agreement to be sold to basically Saudi Arabia and a bunch of private equity firms. It's a private sale. So this is EA, which is currently publicly traded, is going to be a fully owned private company again. Everyone who has shares is getting a payday, and then you will no longer have those shares. It's one of those things. But hey, it's got to talk about who's behind this, right? Selling to Saudi Arabia on its own raises an eyebrow. The people involved are known for dubious human rights. Let's put it that way. Plenty of allegations and proven cases of human rights abuse. And hey, the assassination of that journalist. It's those guys.
They're gonna wholly own EA.
That's not a good look. Also involved is the equity firm of Jared Kushner, who is involved in almost anything. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but I think he's the son-in-law of Trump.
That's right. Yeah.
So also not good. Also not great. This is the second biggest gaming deal ever. Essentially, only second to Activision Blizzard. I think it's the second largest. Might have been the second largest. I think they're calling it LBO or something, or RBO. I forget what the term is. Might be the second biggest private buyout ever of any company. Like some from public back to private. Again, might be wrong on that. I haven't written a note on that, but they're using some pretty big terms for this.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's somewhat madness. Probably doesn't leave Battlefield 6 in a particularly great place, right? It's like, fancy doing that just before you launch one of your biggest Battlefield games. I don't know.
Well,
the timing was
mostly done.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but it's like, this thing's about to come out. If people care about this stuff, it's like it is going to affect sales of that game to some extent.
The only funny thing that I've seen about this is the obvious joke that people immediately made is like, get ready for LIV Tour 26. It's not going to be PGA Tour anymore, obviously.
Oh God, yeah.
Well, they already managed to do EA FC or whatever, so they've done it once.
Well, here's the thing, maybe the Saudis...
Sort of the same.
Well, maybe the Saudis will just pay for the FIFA license there.
Yeah, they get FIFA back. Yeah. Yeah, they practically own FIFA, I'm sure.
Oh, God, maybe you're right. Maybe they just own FIFA,
Well, anyone can own FIFA if you bribe them enough.
Yeah, exactly. The power of bribe.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I heard people saying basically like all the shitty decisions that EA have made all this time that screwed over consumers have basically paid off literally for them.
Right.
For the individuals involved. Yeah. It all worked for them.
Yeah. I mean, all of them, you know, I guess it's not all of the EA's management who have all been bell ends as far as we can tell. You know, they're all getting a massive payday.
Yep.
This is the Bobby Kotick situation all over again. You know, massive bell end gets massive payout.
Yeah.
God damn it. It's pretty annoying. I mean, EA's not been a brilliant company for a long time, but they do still put out the odd good thing. Battlefield 6, to be honest, I feel like it's been shaping up to look like a pretty good Battlefield. And I think they seem to be turning around some of their projects of late. But this, I don't know about this, man. Analysts have been arguing that, like, the Saudis are basically taking a huge bet that EA's transition to AI tools is going to go pretty smoothly, you know, to reduce the costs and improve profitability of what they've been buying into.
Right. Good luck with that.
And I guess they will fund that. And so maybe EA might be the guinea pig, I suppose, for more AI use in games, which probably also isn't good in a great many ways. Worst of it is, of course, Saudi Arabia's views on the LGBTQ plus community are pretty abhorrent. And so a great, you know, a large part of EA's workforce is going to fall into that category. So a lot of them are fearing for jobs if they still want them. It's not a great time.
I mean, I wouldn't have thought that that would make much difference to most of EA studios, unless they literally moved the studios to Saudi Arabia.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know exactly how legally that can possibly work. Like, presumably the studios have to stay where they are, and therefore they'll be governed by their local laws. But
it's more of a principle thing, isn't it?
But yeah, you don't necessarily know how, if management is Saudi, like how they necessarily then treat those studios.
I would imagine that having just bought this thing, they won't be in any particular rush to radically stir things up immediately. I expect they'll just want to have it make some money for a while.
Or hope that it makes money, yeah. yeah, I mean, you're not necessarily right. It's not going to change overnight, but these are all possibilities. It just depends who actually ends up running this thing, who of all those people involved ends up pulling the strings.
Wow.
It's a big deal.
The largest leveraged buyout to date. Amazing.
It is the largest.
According to Wikipedia.
Jeez, okay. Oh, so I was right. LBO, right. Leveraged buyout. All right, then.
All right.
Let's
move on to some good... No, wait.
No, wait. There's more bad news. Sort of similar in some ways, or like here is a case study of a company that did the biggest merger of all time. We're about a year on from that, I guess, a year and a bit at this point since Microsoft acquired Activision Blizzard. Yeah, things aren't necessarily... Microsoft seem to be increasingly all about just making some bucks at any possible cost. And the latest round of that is Game Pass is getting a 50% price hike.
Whoa.
This is insane. It's such
I'd
a...
cancel.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was talking about in previous weeks about, you know, feeling perhaps this is the time to get off the fence and like maybe go do something else. And it's like, this isn't helping. This isn't helping by any amount. So, and the worst part of it is just how Microsoft have been trying to spin this. It's like, oh yeah, here we go. So it's getting an upgrade.
what we're are going- they throwing in, token throwing in to justify this 50% increase in price?
Ubisoft Plus.
Oh, great.
Yeah. You want to play some Ubisoft games? Well, woo, they're now in Game Pass Ultimate. Like, yeah, you get, and it's, Ubisoft Plus, it's not even like the, it's not even the day one. It's a bit like the EA Play stuff, right? That you also currently get in Game Pass. It's like, it's not going to be day one releases from Ubisoft. It's not going to be the most...
Do you get Assassin's Creed Shadows? No.
No, not currently. But Mirage is up there. But Mirage was up there before this even happened. But yeah, there's like up to, I think there was 80 games added to the Ultimate service as a result of this change. So a bunch of stuff has been added to the service, making Game Pass Ultimate now having around 400 plus titles in its library, which is way more than they ever really promised to do right at the start. Right when Game Pass launched, they were talking about being like, "Yeah, we'll it'll probably be a nice steady library of about 100 games," and like, yeah, they're now four times bigger than that as the result of this, which on its own. Yeah, pretty good. Except for the fact, increasing it to £23 a month, it's no longer that great a deal anymore, because it's just not possible to play that many games. Like, having a bigger library is great, and that's no... There's no shade there in increasing the scope of the service. That's brilliant. But no one can play that many games.
Well, maybe you can't, old man with a child.
Well, yeah, that's true. Anyway, let's talk about this, some of the detail here. So in the UK, yeah, it's going up from £15 to £23 for a month for Game Pass Ultimate. The standard tier is now becoming is now being known as the premium tier, and that's increasing to £15 a month. So if you are on standard before, you're now paying for Ultimate but not getting Ultimate. The premium tier has half the library that Ultimate does. So about 200 games, which immediately makes me somewhat annoyed, because it's kind of not obvious what game is on what tier of the service. Like, you just see what you see. If you've got like Game Pass Standard, it just doesn't show you the stuff from Ultimate, I believe. And if you've got Ultimate, it doesn't show you what you would have if you were the tier lower. The other sites maintain that list and try and keep it up to date, but Microsoft themselves like sort of obfuscate all of that, which is quite irritating. There is one advantage to if you're moving to premium now, it does include console and PC at that tier, whereas before, like, standard would only include console, or if you're on Game Pass for PC, you'd only get it for PC. But if you now have Game Pass Premium, you will get both thrown in. And I believe you also get access to cloud streaming on premium now, which was limited to Ultimate before. And they're also upgrading cloud streaming so it can now deal up to 1440p rather than 1080p limit that it had before. So I guess there are upgrades here, but does anyone want them? This is my sort of problem. Like it seems like they're just arbitrarily moving the needle just to make the money go up. And it's... I don't know. Kind of sucks. And I think most of the internet agrees. I don't know if anyone has had a single real good thing sentiment to say about this, to the point where the cancellation site for Game Pass crashed immediately following the announcement.
That's quite funny.
Yeah. And that's been corroborated by multiple sources that, like, yeah, that happened.
So people couldn't even cancel because everyone was trying to cancel.
Because everyone was trying to cancel, yeah. It has not gone down well. So I don't know. I don't know if we'll see a backpedal on this anytime soon, or if Microsoft are just going to stick to their guns and try and do this. But wait, there's more. One of the perks of having Game Pass used to be that DLCs would get a small discount, not a huge discount, but like DLC packs for games that were available on Game Pass you could buy the DLC for stuff that was on Game Pass, right, without owning the base game, which is slightly weird, but you could do it. But you'd get a discount on buying that DLC. Yeah, that's no longer a thing. That's gone. Also gone is the idea that Call of Duty will be available on anything other than the Ultimate tier. That's not happening. All of Call of Duty is now going to be locked behind the Ultimate tier. So it's just bad all round. it's just bad all round. I don't like it. And the thing you mentioned, Dan, just before we went on air, you found did you say Leah Khan? Have I got that right?
Is it
Leanne, sorry, or is it Lee?
I had it there. Whatever it was, Lena.
Lena, sorry. There we go. Yeah. Lena Khan, who was the FTC spokesperson who was trying to block the whole Activision merger. Admittedly, not this isn't necessarily a direct consequence of all of that, but it's. She's now out there saying, like, hey, I told you this would go bad. I told you Microsoft would just, like, would start laying people off. And I told you they would start having to downsize and extend to deal with this. And, yeah, I don't know. It's, I guess she was right. I was optimistic. I was wrong about the merger. But I actually think it's got nothing to... I think the merger is maybe part of it, but I don't think that's the whole story here. Because it's no secret now that Microsoft are basically trimming money off their other departments to funnel into AI research. Like at this point in time, Microsoft supposedly has spent the most on AI research than anyone. I think that's because they've got aren't they involved with OpenAI to some extent? Yes. They're partially owned or something like that. Anyway, they're probably heavily most of that money is probably going straight to OpenAI to fund ChatGPT and get all that sorted or whatever they use to power Copilot behind the scenes. I think it's probably more to do with that Satya Nadella just needs more money for my AI. And they just don't care about Xbox at the moment, I guess.
Yeah, reprioritize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which sucks because, Xbox is profitable. It's been, I haven't got the numbers in front of me, but I did read that it's been one of its most profitable years. And of course it is because it had Call of Duty and Activision behind it, right? And Blizzard and stuff like that. There is more money coming in. If you factor out the fact that they spent 60 or whatever it was, 70 billion on buying Activision Blizzard, take that out of the picture for a second. But just on the numbers, it's like they are the most profitable they've ever been in the Xbox division. Yeah. So, it's really, I hate big companies. I just don't understand why they think the way they do. It's like, this is a profitable thing. Leave it alone. Let it make money.
I guess they have their reasons.
I don't understand them. Anyway, this blows. I've got a few more months of Game Pass still. But I've got some codes that I never claimed as well, so I might just hold off until there's something else I want to play. From a personal perspective, I ran the numbers on what not having Game Pass would be, and it's if I played all of the same games when I played them, even at the increased price, I would save maybe 25%. So in theory, Game Pass is still a good deal for how much I play games. And when I want to play those games. But it's considerably less of a good deal than it was.
And it does, obviously, they're one of the main reasons they do it is it because it influences you in the choice of which games you play.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to get to that. It's I do wonder, whether I would have played the games I played if I didn't have Game Pass. Would I have... given avowed the time of day if I didn't rather than spend the £70 to play avowed? Probably not. I probably wouldn't have spent that 70 quid on getting avowed. Would I have spent £70 on Doom the Dark Ages at launch? It's no, probably not. I probably would have waited for it to come down. It's now half that. You can get it for half that now. So it's and in fairness, I factored that into my equation. I used the current price for Doom because, spoilers for later in the podcast, I'm going to talk about Doom. Yeah, it's so theoretically I would save by still being on Game Pass, but it's like, would I play those same games? I don't know. I don't know if I would. Maybe I need to do this. Maybe I need to cancel to find out. I'd probably play more Nintendo games and probably end up spending a heck of a lot more money because they're Nintendo games.
Because they're Nintendo games.
Yeah. I fucking hate
I'm sure this will be a... This will be a long-running story. I reckon you'll be ranting about this again.
Yeah. Well, we've got to see how it plays out. We've got to see if Microsoft blink.
Yeah, let's see. If they're crashing the cancel page, then and that's the only way they're making money out of games, they might think twice.
Well, sure. I mean, presumably they're making more money now because of the multi-platformness, you know, the fact that they are doing more stuff on PS5. You'd think, like...
Yeah.
The non-Game Pass revenue has gone up, you'd think.
I thought their strategy ought to be to turn Game Pass into Xbox and then put it on PlayStation. Basically be like the Steam, if they could, not that you could ever convince Sony to allow that.
No, that's the bigger problem, yeah, because Sony have their own service. They want you on PlayStation now.
Yeah, yeah. But if there was a way to have competing services on there, that would be a good outcome, along with Steam or whatever.
But then
the Xbox one could be one that works on PC as well. Although I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the other side, right? Because, you know, on PC, Game Pass is still locked to Windows. So, like, Steam Deck, for instance, doesn't have access to Game Pass right now. And it's
you've got to rely on Valve to push the Linux gaming forward, I think.
But you don't necessarily do. Like, Microsoft would need to be able to lean into supporting the Proton layer on Linux, right? Like, I don't know if any of that is actually closed off in a way that they couldn't necessarily do this.
I guess so.
If they made a Linux Game Pass app, but I think some of the problem with like Game Pass is like at the moment, at least on PC, is it's somewhat tied to that. I don't know if it is UWP anymore, but it is kind of tied to that weird other style of app, right? The Windows Store app, rather than just an installed program. It's somewhat tied into that, and I think that's the problem they would have to overcome to try and bring stuff in. They would have to change their philosophy on that in order to bring Game Pass to Linux.
Tangentially related, because this just reminded me mentioning the Xbox app on PC. They updated it quite recently, and it can now detect Steam games, basically. It's detecting the games that are installed on your system, even if they're in Steam.
Oh, interesting.
So you could theoretically launch them from the Xbox app, I guess.
Oh. Is that only for games that you could have installed through the Xbox app, or just all games?
No, I think it's all of them. Like, it's picking up all kinds of... every game that I've played recently, and I'm pretty sure not all of them are on Game Pass.
Right, so that does kind of make sense, because people have had like a hands-on with the, you know, the Xbox ROG Ally, right, that thing, which has an updated Xbox launcher, but, you know, that thing is just a Windows thing, so it's like that launcher should be able to is designed to be able to play games from the other stores. So yeah, maybe this is a precursor to that new launcher becoming more widely available.
Of course, the slightly annoying thing about it is that, like, now when you look at your library in the Windows Games app, it just lists everything, and then you have to then like click a tag to only show you the ones that actually Game Pass. You know, the ones that you wanted to play through this app.
Yeah. Well, I've taken to just pinning the ones I'm currently playing to the start bar, like, so I don't have to go through that app. Avoid it where I can. Because it's still not great. It's better than it was. I'll give it some credit. It's better than it was. That's all I got for news.
That's the news.
Happy days.
Well, don't forget about... I don't think we talked about on the podcast, because we did talk about it last week for sure, but we haven't talked about Powerhold, but not Powerhold.
Oh yeah, right. What was this? There was another one, wasn't there? Someone else is trying to get in on this.
No, not that one.
Not that one. Right. Okay.
The one that came out very shortly after the Nintendo Direct, where the Poketopia was.
Right. Yeah.
Then they announced Pal Farm, the you know, ripoff of Animal Crossing, but for power.
Great. Wait. Hang on. What Pocket Pair? Are mate. Wait, so this is a pocket player
another toy. Game, yes.
Oh, okay. Did we talk about this? I don't remember this.
After Pokemon Legit Pokemon announced its weird Minecrafty farming thing.
Yes, so basically what happened was at the Nintendo Direct, the Pokemon company are making their Poketopia. Animal Crossing, basically, Poketopia or whatever it's called.
I think it's just...
And then, like, a couple of days later, Palworld are like, hey, we're making basically the same thing, which is very funny in the concept of, like, the lawsuits and everything that are ongoing. Wow. But, like, it almost seems like it was a funny, like, you know, shitpost response. But this can't have been, like, something that they just knocked up in, like, a couple of days. Like, this must have been something they've been working on for months, at least, before this even happened. But it was a good bit of timing. But, yes, it does just look like Animal Crossing / Stardew Valley, but with the Pal World, you know, all the pals and... And they do the thing that, like, the Pokemon do, where they water the plants, and like they do in Power World, which is also, like, why that was in Power World in the first place.
Do they still have guns?
Not farming obviously. Guns? There is a moment where they have a chainsaw for cutting down trees, so, you know, probably still guns. But yeah, I don't know. That was just a funny bit of timing.
Boy. I mean, I didn't write down or talk about, like, combine that with the ex-Capcom dev whose name I've forgotten, Okanata or something, like, saying that that Power World is tantamount to war.
Right. I mean, presumably that comment must have been after the Power Farm announcement. Also, I guess Power World has announced that they're actually going to do, like, their 1.0 release next year, for real. It's not going to be early access any longer.
Nice.
They made it to 1.0, potentially, without getting shut down.
Yes.
Wow, amazing. And that is the news.
Woo.
Woo, it's time for what you've been playing. I've been playing a game. Even though I had Nintendo games to play, I've been playing a game that Rob already played. Indiana Jones, I've been playing.
Oh, hell yeah. Cool.
And it's pretty good.
It's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's available on PlayStation, which is good. That's why I've been playing it. Yeah. It's making me think of Deus Ex, lol.
Oh, really?
Right, because I feel like I really like the detail in the environments and stuff, and like I like that they are, like, I've only done the one hub world so far is the Vatican City.
Right, yeah.
And I know it's composed of multiple of those, but like that would be a good, like, Deus Ex kind of level, you know what I mean?
Mm.
But it's just not quite immersive sim enough, but it is pretty immersive simmy. It's like quite comparable.
Yeah, you know what I mean, it's pretty close.
Wandering around, and then there are stealth sections, and then, but you can interact with objects and like read things and talk. There's no like dialogue trees, right? So,
no.
Is that true? Yeah. So you don't have any like conversations where you can actually like quiz people or choose things. But I guess that's not very indie. Is it? He's not a detective. He doesn't. He's a man.
He's not a detective in that way, right? He detects history.
Yeah, exactly. By like looking at objects and stuff, and that fits really well. I think after having some reservations, seeing the trailers and stuff, I actually think it's a good performance.
It's really good.
Indiana Jones. It's really good. It's a slightly different take on the character, which is good. But it feels like in Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it's pretty Harrison Ford like in his delivery, right? Like he's definitely leaning into that. But
it is a kind of, it's not just an impression though. Like it's a good,
sure,
it's a good, and it works. And it's definitely that aspect of Indiana Jones where he's kind of the smartest guy, despite what you might think, you know, where he's leaning into the kind of Dr. Jones aspect of it, the archaeology stuff of it. So that's good. It's just this AAA games, isn't it? Or AA games or whatever, where it's like it does feel like gameplay is to a certain extent dumbed down, but that's okay. I mean, the combat's fine. Like the stealth is fine. I quite like that it's, you just have, you, there are a million different items, but they all basically do the same thing.
Kind of, yeah.
Right? There's bottles, I guess, which you can throw and stuff like that, but mostly you just brain people. Yeah. Whatever comes to the hand.
I was like, what have I got? Oh, I've got funny. Some sort of random stick. Okay, yep, that's gonna, yeah, that's gonna that be used stick. For knocking you out as best I can.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I know what you mean about the sort of not quite Deus Ex-iness, because like everything, yeah. Like the areas in which there are this stuff to do, right, like are obviously bordered, right? It's like here you're in a do yeah. stuff area.
Yeah, exactly.
And there tends to be a way of doing it rather than like go and do lots of, you could approach this from lots of different angles. It's like, no.
Because that was the Deus Ex thing, wasn't it? Yeah. You could try this in different ways and it was janky and it didn't actually work most of the ways, but yeah. you know, you could still try. Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could climb a building if you get enough boxes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot more constrained in that way.
I have noticed that like it breaks the, what I consider the Uncharted rule, where in Uncharted, there seems to be a rule where cool action things cannot happen in cutscenes. They have to happen in gameplay.
Right,
and
yes.
This breaks that rule quite a few times. In, like, he does Indiana Jonesy things in cutscenes. It's like, well, it wouldn't have been fun if I was playing that.
I mean, it only gets wilder later on from that perspective. Yeah, but there's definitely plenty of that, yeah.
That seems like a miss for sure, because... But I guess the actual gameplay itself doesn't support... enough.
That's the thing, yeah, because
be like, to do that kind of thing,
it's
because it's first person.
I mean, it's a hell of an undertaking for, yeah, I mean, you might have to swap out to a different camera, which they do periodically, right, for some of the climbing.
Yeah,
anyway. I mean, that's where a game gets expensive fast, right? That's why only Uncharted did what it was doing at the time, and why no one and why still nobody else or very few people actually try and attempt an Uncharted like game, right? No, I mean, nobody's really doing
just
it.
Just the effort going into the animation of doing that stuff. It, I mean, more than just the graphics. Like, this is an amazing looking game. I think it a DF gave it their graphics of the year or whatever last year.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, especially on, and it looks great on the base PS5. I mean, PS5 is insanely powerful, I guess. But I think it's mostly the like. It's the lighting, right? Which is, I think it's the same stuff as Doom, right? It's the id Tech.
Yeah, I think it is id Engine. Yeah.
So that all looks good. And the character stuff is good. I have noticed, like, it's annoying watching those Digital Foundry videos because when they point out the flaws, you then notice them more in the actual game. But, like, I find it fun. I mean, it is very noticeable. Like, the classic thing is it drops a frame on camera cuts.
Right, or whatever,
which is, like... Once you know that's there, and like every game does that, but which makes total sense, right?
Side effect of a lot of temporal processing we now do, yeah.
Yeah, but it's nice. I like that I think the size of the environments is like, allows for enough detail, right? You know, without making it ludicrous, like I guess what GTA is going to be, you know? Mm. So it works. I think they've made smart choices on the scope of the game, and it's quite I don't know, it's quite fun.
Yeah, and you're only in the first area. There's
there's plenty more.
Yeah,
yeah, but yeah, I've been enjoying it so far, and they've chosen well in terms of Indiana Jones locations so far. Like, I think the next one is probably Egypt or whatever. I think that's actually a location from the first film, but like the Vatican is like an obvious indie location, right?
Sure.
So yeah, it works. And but I will say that despite the graphics being really good, like venturing into old tombs and stuff for some reason doesn't feel that creepy. I don't know why, because it looks good. But it should be like, you should be sort of trepidation or something going into a dank.
No enough spiders or traps.
Yeah, spiders and things. Yeah, there aren't like, yeah, spiders or traps. But I'm sure that will increase as I go on, as I continue.
Oh, cool. No, I'm glad you're enjoying it. Yeah.
It's pretty good. I wanted a relatively linear kind of story.
Sure, yeah.
After big roaming things, and
I mean, it's definitely not a tight eight, and like the game sets itself up to be played. You know, the story plays linearly, but yeah. I wouldn't worry too much about necessarily like missing things in the Vatican.
Yeah.
Like there's loads to do there, and you can, I think you can do nearly all of it. Like, whilst
I think
you're
I've
there.
Done enough. I'm not doing the collecty stuff. I can't be bothered.
Right, yeah. I think you can do nearly all of it while you're there. But, you know, you will, when you go to the second area, you will get the ability to just return whenever you want. And,
right,
you know,
okay.
And you'll be powered up and stuff. It doesn't make any sense plot-wise that you would do yeah, that, but you can.
Okay, that's good to know. Cool. That's me. Who's not gone, Zach?
Well, I mean, I've continued to play quite a lot of Against the Storm yes. on that new save file, relearning all the systems. Although it's actually, the thing is that because of the meta progression of that game, like you, when you finish a town and you get the end of level resources or whatever, those unlock the unlocks on the meta progression tree. But like, there's actual game mechanics that are locked in that tree. So like, you don't actually have access to like the rain punk system where your buildings can be powered up by extracting certain the different seasonal rainwaters and stuff. Mm. Like rain you don't punk. Even yeah cool. you can't even cool. do that until you unlock it on the tech tree basically.
Okay.
And then also some of the features don't toggle on until you go up enough difficulty levels either. Like once you have the rain punk. If you're still playing at the second difficulty level, there's no downside to the rain punk stuff. Like you can turn on the water usage in the buildings and it's basically just a bonus. Like the buildings just produce more. But then if you go up the next difficulty level, then when you're using the rain punk, it like creates corruption basically. That then when the storm comes, the corruption tries to put out the fire and everything. So you so then you have another separate building to deal with that. So it's like there's this weird mechanical like step between you unlock the mechanic, but then if you're not playing on a high enough difficulty, you're still only seeing half of that mechanic even.
Okay.
But yeah, I've been continuing to relearn everything about that. I've played that game in little spurts far enough apart that they keep rebalancing things all the time. So it's like every time I've played it again, I do have to keep relearning stuff. And there's also a matter of obviously the roguelikeness of it, where you're just like, when you're going into those unknown glades and there's a random event in them or whatever, in the bigger ones, it's the sort of roguelike problem of just like learning them, like opening enough of those glades to learn what all the possible events are and what all the possible materials you might need are to deal with them, so you know whether it's safe to open them in the future or whatever.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I guess you could learn the probabilities to an extent as well.
Yeah, but I don't know if it was since the last time I played or the time before, they also rebalanced all the glade events to be a bit more forgiving, because they used to always be like, if you didn't have the specific materials, you were basically boned. But then they changed it slightly to make it so that every event has like two options and they have different resource requirements depending on which one of the options you're doing. So
right,
most
yeah,
of the time,
I think we saw
you can get
in
into
video,
one or
right?
the other. Yeah, I think so. But it's a matter of like, because you can then have an option to do the other thing, that increases the like likelihood that you're going to have the materials that you need to deal with it in some way or the other. Maybe not the way you want to. Like, I've had a couple of cases where it's like, I open a glade and I think it's going to be good, and then it's like, oh wait, this is the one event that I needed that one material for, but I don't have that, so I'll have to solve it the other way that sucks. Where the reward is much worse. But at least it doesn't explode or whatever, as those events kind of tend to do.
You're skipping the bad side, anyway.
Well, you're skipping the failure, but you're winning in a less good way.
Yeah.
And also, like, the other thing about playing, I guess, like, a fresh save in this game is that because you're also getting XP to level up, apart from leveling up the meta progression tree, and there's also unlocks in the XP progression, so just playing it more unlocks more events and stuff. But then that also is like, I've gone back to how in this sort of early game balance, like trading is the kind of the optimal solution to everything. Like, just make a shit ton of money and buy everything you need.
Right.
Which means that then you're kind of railroaded into always looking to pick the same kinds of buildings. Like, you want the provisioner that can make the packs of provisions that are required to run trade routes.
Right.
It's like a real economy.
Yep.
Specialize in one boring thing and then
pay for everything. I think the provisions is the one that has always stood out as being like, I don't understand why they never really rebalanced that, because you remember how the recipes have like a star rating of like how efficient they are, basically. Yeah. You always have the makeshift post building that can make provisions at like zero stars. So you can always get provisions. It's just like super inefficient.
Hmm.
And then the provisioner, which you think would be the best building for making provisions, is only a 2-star provision recipe, and there's no 3-star building, and there's only like one other 1-star building. So it really does like super railroad you into only ever getting the provisioner if you want to do trade.
Right.
Which is slightly weird, because there's a lot of other buildings where there's, you know, you could have multiple buildings that have 3-star options for the same item. And then it just depends on what like the secondary options you might want are. Or perhaps what type of worker you want in that building, if it's a lizard in a warm building or whatever. But then also, somehow I discovered a like tactic that I hadn't ever, I guess I'd never tried it before, but like there's one of the random bonuses that you get at the start of the year. It's like when you finish a trade route, the queen's impatience grows slower for like a couple of minutes by 30% slower. And I always thought, oh, that doesn't sound like that much of a bonus.
Yeah.
And also, like, I guess the other reason I'd never done it was because, like, I was never really struggling to win, but in, like, the time limit of the Queen's Impatience before.
Hmm.
But I randomly decided to try that, and it's actually insanely overpowered because, firstly, the way the trade routes work is, like, the more stuff you trade at once, the longer the trade route takes and the more money you make. But if you have a wide selection of goods, you can just do really short, quick trade routes. And then every time you finish one of those trade routes, it creates another stack of that buff, and the buff stacks. So you only need to complete 3 trade routes simultaneously, and then Queen's Impatience is 0%. So it basically just pauses the time limit. So as long as you can maintain a constant cadence of trade routes coming in like every 30 or 40 seconds, you can basically have zero impatience grow for the entire time and then have unlimited time to do whatever the hell you want, which is a hilariously overpowered tactic at this point. But again, another way trading is like the number one overpowered tactic this early stage of the game. Mm.
Pro tip.
I do remember it getting less powerful as I got into like the harder difficulties and the more complicated, like higher tiers of unlocks in the tech tree or whatever. Other tactics started to become more useful, but trading is always pretty useful. And it's also one of those things where it's just like you can run it in parallel to everything else, and it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really cost you anything. It's just the provisions that you need to run the trade routes and a small amount of whatever the trade routes want you to sell.
Yeah, so you still need that one thing for provisions, but like you can do something else alongside it.
Yeah. So yeah, I play quite a lot more of that, and I probably might continue playing more of it. But I have also been playing a whole bunch more Vintage Story, because obviously we've still...
Right.
The multiplayer has still not been happening that much, so we still haven't progressed much further in that. But I did finally, in my solo vanilla run through, finally get to that first dungeon. After all this goddamn time. It was kind of ridiculous because... Well, I think I mentioned it last time that the main reason I wasn't doing it at that point was because it was winter. And it was just like, I didn't want to travel all the way there in the middle of winter. But I had like basically everything else prepared at that point. But then once it got to spring, and I was like, okay, now the snow has gone away. Now it's time to go, right? But then I just kept getting like distracted by a bunch of other things. Because it's one of those classic situations where like a bunch of timers expired at the same time, basically, where it's like, oh, my pigs have just given birth, so I need to deal with that. Oh, my goats are all going to give birth in like another couple of days. Oh, my crops need harvesting. Oh, there's a temporal storm coming and I need to deal with that before we go on this trip. So it still took me until like June until I actually went to this dungeon,
right?
But yeah, I went and did it, and it was kind of interesting and kind of spooky in a way that that game tries to be kind of spooky, but...
Is it spookier than Indiana Jones?
Probably, actually, yeah. It's like you come down, the entrance is just a vertical ladder, and you come down into this big cave, and it's basically a sort of globe-shaped cave, right? It's just a big circle excavated in the rock with like walkways going around the edge. But when you first go down there, of course, it's super dark, so you can't see anything. You just like you're on this rickety-looking wooden walkway around the edge, and there's just black off the side. But there's something out there that's just continuously making a noise, like this mechanical whirring noise out there in the middle of this open space, which is definitely kind of creepy.
Okay.
And then even when you eventually make your way slightly further into the dungeon, because the way they've set this dungeon system up is like it prevents you from building or destroying anything. So you can't place blocks and you can't mine blocks or anything else. So it's all set, all the geometry is set, which obviously that makes sense because they want you to work your way through the dungeon in a specific way. But then that also includes like sort of a little bit of puzzle element where it's like if you read little messages that hint that you can turn the power back on by starting up the steam engine or whatever, and then you're like, oh, this steam engine is missing these parts, so you have to go and find these other parts around the place to rebuild it. But then when you do turn the lights on by booting up the power system, all the walkways around the edge of the room get illuminated, so you can like see the extent of this cave you're in. But whatever's in the middle is still in pitch blackness, and it's like, oh, that's just made it slightly more creepy in a way. Yeah. You can sort of see the outline of it in like the shadow of it where you're looking, because it obscures the other side of the walkways on the other side of the room. And it's like, what is that? Don't even know. And I guess you never will know, because you even when you fully power up that dungeon, it never illuminates that middle bit. Like you can go all the way down into the bottom of the, like the bowl of the hemisphere of the cave and walk up to the bottom of whatever this thing is, but it right. it's like, oh, it looks like metal plating, I guess, but you can't see any of the rest of it.
Weird. That's kind of cool.
And then like once you finish, as I mentioned, there's the little boss fight, which was kind of awkward. I mean, combat in that game isn't super complicated, I guess. It doesn't have any mechanics really. It's kind of like Minecraft. You just swing a sword at a thing and it does damage. And that's about it. So yeah, it has a boss fight where you're just basically, it's got like the boss has a couple of moves where it's like, oh, the ground pound where you avoid the shockwave by jumping, and then if you get close it does a swipe attack, and then at a certain point it spawns a bunch of little extra spiders or whatever. The main problem with that,
yeah.
The main problem with that fight is healing, because like the ground pound shockwave that it does knocks you into the air, and that cancels your healing.
While you're in the middle of healing.
Yeah.
Oh no.
But I'm not sure if this is the intended way to do it. But I discovered that there's pillars in the corners of the room, and if you like stand behind one of the pillars so you're not directly in line of sight, and then crouch, I guess that counts as being stealth, and like the boss just forgets you're there. So then you can just heal quickly.
You found a way to choose it. Okay.
Which is kind of like, I'm not sure that's intended, but also maybe it's not intended for it to be completely impossible to heal otherwise. Because I had seen in the patch notes coming up to this release that they mentioned like making it so you could heal in midair or heal while jumping, but I don't think it fully worked because I couldn't. Although that's also a matter of the fact that I was using like super heavy armor, which also the main penalty of heavy armor, or one of the main penalties of heavy armor, is it makes it take longer for you to apply the healing.
Oh, okay. Right.
So probably if I was wearing lighter armor, I might have been able to get the healing off in between the ground pounds or whatever.
That kind of makes sense from a flavor perspective, right? That heavy armor would make it harder to avoid bandages and stuff.
Yes. I mean, I suppose if you were really quick on the inventory system, you could like literally take your armor off for a second, apply the healing, and then put it all back on.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got through that boss fight, and then there's a big like library at the end of the dungeon, which just has a bunch of lore stuff in it. And I guess there was a few little other bits of, because most of the dungeon is just like what you would expect from like an underground, like facility, well, sort of medieval facility, I suppose, like living quarters, and here's the well, and here's the room where they make all these weird mechanical monsters that you've been fighting the whole time. But then the other thing about it that is also sort of hinted at in the lore and probably has to do with the giant whatever it is in the middle of the room, and is also a sort of overall element of the whole world of this game, the temporal stability, which is like, it's kind of like a sanity meter in the normal process of the game, where it's like if you stand too close to the temporal rifts, the world goes all warpy and then more enemies start spawning. But then the lore of that you get in this dungeon sort of implies that maybe this whole thing is basically like displaced out of time or something. That might be what the thing in the middle is actually doing. Like it sent this whole dungeon to a completely different place and time. And there's also some elements of that shown in the design of the dungeon. Like there's certain rooms near the sort of outskirts of the dungeon where like the actual geometry has gone weird. Like there's one bedroom where like the whole room just repeats several times over. And there's another one where the whole room repeats, but it's mirrored and on the ceiling instead.
Oh, cool. That was cool.
So yeah, that was pretty neat. But yeah, you get through this whole dungeon. Then I spent probably far too long like looting it, because the problem is that you can't really carry that much stuff on you. But then in order to bring the loot out of this dungeon, you've got to climb up and down that giant ass ladder. So it's like,
oh, the one that you go in by.
Yeah, you climb all the way down this ladder, then you run through all the different rooms on these three levels of walkways collecting shit, and then you bring it all back up, and then you do that like four or five times depending on how much of this stuff you actually want to loot.
And you couldn't spare a warp stone?
No, well, you can't really warp in that way. I did set my spawn at the dungeon in case I died, which I turned out I didn't, so that was kind of pointless.
Need to make a kind of bomb theme type thing as you climb a really long ladder.
Yeah. I was kind of expecting there to be a teleporter in the dungeon to like bring you back out of it, because the teleporters do exist in this world. They're all over the place, in fact. And there is one inside the dungeon in the context of the dungeon that like takes you to a separate like mine area. But like there's no, I was expecting there to be like, you know, the classic like get through the boss and then there's a teleporter that takes you out kind of thing. But there wasn't. It's just like you just have to climb back up that big ass ladder. So I did that. And then even once you've hauled all the stuff to the exit of the dungeon, now you have to take it all home, which is like a day's walk away or whatever. Approximately a day for me. Well, a day's sprint, I guess. But then there was one thing that made that slightly easier, which is the sort of bigger reward for finishing that dungeon, apart from the stuff that's in the dungeon, is now you can go to the adventurer who sent you there in the first place, and he'll sell you an elk that you can ride, like a horse.
Nice.
And then you can equip it with like saddlebags and all that stuff. So that makes shipping, makes you move faster and gives you a whole extra inventory to stuff full of loot. So then I was using that to ship all the crap back home.
Sweet.
And then the next part of the story, which is like chapter two, I guess, it's now like, now you can go to a town, maybe. I hear that's what it is.
Get hyped for town.
Get hyped for town. But it's just like, I'll mark that on your map like I did with the dungeon. And it's like, oh, it's a bit further away than the dungeon was in another direction, but it's still going to be, you know, now you've got the elk, so you can ride it there, I suppose. But so it'll probably take approximately the same amount of time to get there. And now winter's already coming again. So it's like, I'm probably not going to get to that for a whole nother several in-game months, because I've got to get through this next winter. I don't know if it slows down the elk, I guess. I haven't tried that yet. Maybe it's fine in the winter. I mean, I'll still have the food consumption problem, I suppose. Because I did, like, before I went into the dungeon, I set up, like, a base camp or whatever at the entrance and, like, took a bunch of food over there beforehand so I could stay there for multiple days, which was definitely necessary. So I don't know what's going to go on with this town. Presumably there'll be, I don't know, an inn, maybe? Maybe you just buy food?
But you've never seen that before, so...
No, so I don't know any of how this system works. And then there's also some kind of second boss fight at some point, apparently.
Maybe it's abandoned.
Well, I don't think it is, because there's, like, certain mentions of, like, NPCs, basically.
Right.
In like, the handbook, which is, like, the in-game Wikipedia, basically. It hides quite a... It doesn't exactly hide information. It just doesn't... A lot of the things in there are just items... Like, it's basically a giant list of every item in the game, but a lot of it is, like, without context. But then you can see, like, here's a bunch of clothes that all have a specific naming convention that seems to suggest they're worn by a certain type of person who might live in a certain type of town type place. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's up with that. Or the second boss. But who knows if I'll get to that. I don't know, like... It wasn't, that first boss wasn't super difficult when I was wearing basically a heavy iron armor. And obviously, as I said before, the only tier higher than that is steel armor, which I'll, I mean, I guess that's probably one thing I'll end up doing while this winter is happening this year. Get the steel process started. Although I don't know if I'll be able to, even within like 6 months of this winter, I don't know if I'll be able to make enough steel for a whole set of steel armor. Because it's, A lot of ingots of steel that you need to make. And the whole steel making process takes a real long time as well, because you're like, first of all, you have to build this whole like furnace arrangement, and then you have to like bury ingots of iron in a sack of coal, essentially. And then you have to set a bunch of coal under the furnace alight to start to heat the whole thing up. And then you have to keep it fueled for like a week. And then eventually you get some amount of steel, but like only like, I think you can do 16 ingots at a time. And like, if you wanted to do a full set of plate armor, that's probably like, I don't know, more than 30 ingots. So you're going to need to do like two runs of this steel furnace if you wanted to make steel armor. So yeah, that's a lot of effort. And I'd also still have to make more iron, because I don't even have that much iron to start with. So I'd have to run the iron furnaces to make the iron and then turn it into steel in the steel furnace.
Right, and then make the armor. Oh my gosh.
But yeah, I've got 6 months of in-game time to mess with that, I suppose. If anything, if nothing else, I guess I could make like the first batch of steel, I could make steel weapons. I guess that would be still beneficial. You know, less not the defense, but at least the damage output. So yeah, that's Vintage Story. Still chipping away at that. I feel like I'm kind of, yeah, well, obviously, because I'm talking about Steel at this point, but I'm kind of running out of things to do. Especially at my home base, where it's just like, I've built, apart from the steel furnace, I've built pretty much everything at this point.
Right.
Got the greenhouse, got the pottery furnace, got kind of at the windmill system.
The things that you have left to do are kind of annoying to do.
Well... Not necessarily annoying, but like long term. Which is like making that steel furnace and running that. And also because that, again, it's adding another one of those timers, basically, where it's like, well, if I need to keep this steel furnace stoked with coal for an entire week, I have to be there to do that. So I can't like wander off and do other things. I mean, I can do other things at home, but I don't have anything else to do at home. So what am I going to do?
Keep an eye on it for a week.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know if I'll get to Chapter 2 of Vintage Story. I doubt they'll probably release Chapter 3 before I get to Chapter 2 if I do continue playing it. But the next patch that they've already started talking about is supposedly going to do a bit of a rework on the like mechanical power systems that come from the windmill and everything for the automated forge hammer and the crusher and all that kind of stuff that powers off the windmill. Because I mean, it's a kind of cool system in like that medieval tech kind of way, but it doesn't really go anywhere. Like you set it up and that's it. There's not really a second stage to its progress or anything. So yeah, that's Vintage Story. And then
vintage.
I played a bunch of Rocket League. Once again, I find myself playing more Rocket League than I should be, that's for sure. for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe I'm subconsciously attracted to the weird new mall aesthetic of the new level. Or Sonic, I guess, because there's the Sonic crossover at the moment.
Yeah, I saw that.
Maybe that's all I need. I occasionally hear Sonic sound effects coming out of gold explosions.
Okay.
I mean, that is pretty satisfying. What if, like, if they added Escape to the City as a soundtrack?
They haven't put any music in, as far as I'm aware.
Ah, disappointing.
Not even in the goal as part of a goal explosion or anything.
I mean, it's
just sound effects.
I mean, it could just be the start of that, right? The sort of ptharrung, dung, 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 dung,
dung, dung, dung. Yeah, that'd be kind of funny. I mean, they should have put it in as, you know, one of the goal themes. Just, you know. Or any Sonic music is one of those gold themes. I don't think there's any that I've heard.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, it's like a get a new life sound or something.
Well, that one is in,
or something. Or
I think that sound effect is in for some reason on the like supersonic gold explosion.
Oh, okay.
Which doesn't really make any sense. You should have. I guess there isn't really an obvious sound effect to Supersonic.
Really, no, there isn't really.
It's like in Sonic 3, it's like that. It uses the same sound effect that a lot of things do in that game.
Yeah.
And then I guess I played a small amount of Deep Rock because it's Rocktoberfest. Get your dumb new pretzel hat. But that would be a convenient segue into something that Rob's been playing.
Rob, what have you been playing?
I've been playing Deep Rock Survivor.
The other Deep Rock game.
Deep Rock Collection.
The current second Deep... Well, I guess it's not even them, actually, is it? It's a different studio.
No, it is a different studio, yeah. I mean, Ghost Ship are obviously involved, but they're not like... they're not the primary developer on this game. And you can kind of tell, to some degree, like... So Deep Rock Galactic Survivor is the Vampire Survivors.
Vampire Survivors.
Yeah, but themed to Deep Rock Galactic. But I think that's almost immediately, that's where my problems with this somewhat begin. Rob Review, here we go. Like, it doesn't feel Deep Rock enough in the game sense, right? Like, Deep Rock Galactic has this gnarly and, like, pretty cool, like, I wouldn't call it low poly, but like very obviously hard edged aesthetic to everything, right? Like, yeah. Like it doesn't necessarily smooth shade between things. It's all like crisp edges. They don't do that here. They sort of just render it like naturally, like a little bit. They kind of had the same problem to a certain extent with the board game, but like the Deep Rock Galactic board game. But yeah, I can give it a pass there, right? It's not as much of a problem, but like
because it's hard to render real life in a specific way.
Sure, yeah. Here in Survivor, it's like, yeah, why haven't they used the hard edged look to it? Like, why haven't they done that? And I guess to a certain extent, it doesn't matter because like it's a Survivor's game, so you're playing quite zoomed out from a top down perspective, and maybe you wouldn't see any of that anyway. But yeah, it's not there. It's clearly not doing that. And I have a bit of a problem with that. I think that's not the Deep Rock aesthetic.
They failed on the Deep Rock branding.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, the game itself is, it's fine. I can't necessarily say too much wrong with it in terms of how it plays. Like it's still like Vampire Survivors, it's kind of split into runs, but unlike Vampire Survivors' timer mechanic. Which kind of still exists in the main runs. It's kind of split into five stages. It's like a deep dive, kind of. So you do a map first of all, and try and mine what you can from it. But there's like a target for it. And at least in these first set of missions, you get the target is always an enemy. It's like after a certain period of time, things start happening. So you'll get swarms. You'll get there could be supply pods dropped down and you need to mine away the stuff around where the supply drop is coming. And then stand there long enough to call it in and things like that. So it's got like mechanics that are They're not mysterious like Vampire Survivors, like, but it's got more upfront mechanics than Vampire Survivors does, right? It's not just about surviving necessarily at first, but there's more objectives to it, and some of those are like straight out of the game, right? Like get apocalypse blooms, get some Bulu caps, go mine some Morkite with your bare hands, that kind of stuff. Like it's definitely pulling from the things you do in the main game and just adding them to it here, but the core of it is very much just like Survivors. It's kill some stuff, they drop some XP. When you get a certain amount of XP, you upgrade your stuff. Unlike Survivors, the when you get stuff is a little bit more rigid. So you can have a loadout of 4 weapons at a time, but when you get the ability to add to your pool of weapons, always happens at a specific level. So, you know, I forget what those numbers are, but you get to a certain, like, level 10 or something, and it's like, okay, great, now have a second gun. And then you'll get to level 15. It's like, okay, great, have your third gun. And it's like, it's like that by clockwork. And there's an element to that with the gun upgrade trees as well. So the gun, when you level up, like, just like Vampire Survivors, you get a... actually, does it happen? Yeah, well... Anyway, Vampire Survivors, I think, is a little different because, like, you have to find the chests in order to get the upgrades and stuff like that. Like, here you get a choice of what to upgrade whenever you level up, and it'll be like, do this, this, or this. And those come in various tiers, so there'll be common versions and all the way up to legendary versions of those upgrades, and that doesn't necessarily change what they do, it just changes how much of what they do. So you could get a gun upgrade, and that will reduce your reload time by this amount of thing. Because reloading is a thing, but it's all automatic. You're never pushing a button to shoot or anything like that. It's very much just move around. That's all the Survivors games are. Just move. And it's the same here. But yeah, you upgrade your gun level then goes up. And then when you've do a certain number of gun upgrades and your gun level reaches a certain level, that's when you get an overclock. And that is, again, slightly by clockwork. Like, you'll always get overclocks at this level, and this level. The first two levels are going to be slightly less interesting, and the third level overclock is going to be a bit more wild, like something a bit more interesting that you can choose to do. But I think that's... this kind of leans into, I think, what is my biggest problem with Survivor. Like, all of that is fine, and it functions, and it's, yeah, it works, and it plays, and I've been having a good time with it. But it's not a wild time. It's not a crazy time. It's like you go into Vampire Survivors, and shit is weird. At all times, and it's like it's sort of partly due to how the pure randomness of the unlock system in Vampire Survivors. It, at least from the gate, it feels like there's just way more in Vampire Survivors than there is here. I feel like the results you can reach in Vampire Survivors are way crazier than the results you can reach here. And they look crazier as well, because, hey, it's Deep Rock Galactic theme, so there's a lot of just guns. Right, they're shooting tiny little pellets out from your person. Right, you're not like chucking massive scythes everywhere. Or there are more interesting stuff, like the flamethrower exists, like, and then the gunk cannon exists if you're playing as like Driller, right? And if you're an engineer, you will get turrets that you can put down and stuff like that. Yeah, there's put themselves down when you stop moving. That's how that functions. But and you get guns that have electric bullets and things like that, but it's not as mad as throwing cats at people. It just isn't, and it just can't be, right? Because it's not Deep Rock if you did that. And so I think that's the only thing that's kind of the biggest thing going against it. It's like, it's a different flavor of the Survivor game, but is it as cool? Does it make me smile as much? No, it doesn't. And it's as far as it's right now, like, there's not a lot of intrigue to what's going on. Like, I'm not really interested necessarily, or not really excited about what's going to come next, what I might discover, what weird secrets I don't understand at all, which Vampire Survivors is full of. there's so much oddity, there's so much weirdness. Like, there's a whole like spell casting section in the menu where it's like, what on earth do I do in here?
Would you feel any more like that if you didn't already know it was Deep Rock? Like, if you didn't already know Deep Rock stuff, any of it feel weird?
I mean, maybe, but I don't know. I'm not sure it does, really.
I mean, probably not to some extent, because it is just like guns shooting things.
Guns shooting bugs, right? Like, it's all on theme. Admittedly, I haven't seen any like robots or anything like that, so I don't know if the rivals are there. I don't know if any of the plague stuff is there. I haven't encountered any of that. Maybe they'll turn up later. Because the only other mission type I've discovered so far is the drill dozer, the Omer and Hart style missions. And those are like only 3 stages long, but they are basically escort missions. You've got to stand in the zone while the drill, and when you're standing in the zone, the drill moves. And every now and then it runs out of fuel, so you got to go get some oil shale, and then stand in the zone again and it moves on. So it's a little bit different, but yeah, it's still a pretty rigid structure. And those levels tend to just be a straight line. Like, it's just one corridor.
Just like Deep Rock.
Yeah, pretty much. it looks good. You know, the visual fidelity is fine, even if it's not all sharp edged and themed like Deep Rock. It's doesn't sound bad, because obviously it's just pulling music from Deep Rock as well, so the music's all good. So which is fine. I do turn down the main sound track, because it's a bit like has the same problem that Vampire Survivors does, is that after a while there's just like, it's just noise. Right, there's just too much blah, 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 just going on. Well, I mean, guns firing and flames going and everything, so I just turn all that down a little bit so I can hear the music and hear the voice work, which is, again, half lifted from Deep Rock and half new. There are new lines here. There's new new dialogue and stuff like that. Like, Mission Command is very keen to tell you that the supply drop site is full of crap.
Do you think that is...
full of crap.
Do you think it's the same guy? Or did they
I think it's the same. I think it's the same actor, yeah. Yeah, Mission Control and the dwarves all sound the same. So I don't think they read, like, some of the voice lines seem like directly ripped from Deep Rock. Even with the same pitching, right? You know, it's all the same guy, but they still pitch the voices, you know, for the various dwarves. So yeah, it's fine. It seems to, I mean, I don't know the extent of the content. I think it's got plenty of stuff. I think it's got stuff, plenty more to unlock. As I go through it, but it's a doesn't necessarily carry the soul of Big Boy Deep Rock.
Fair,
and maybe that's what I should have expected. You know, it's definitely not as full blown. It's not as full budget as, you know, you can tell all that stuff. Like, but it's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right. What else I've been doing? I talked a little bit about Octahedron last time. Like, I've played a bit more of that, got a little bit further through it. Really like the music in that game. It's really good. Sort of semi-chip, semi-trance beats. Like, it's like, it doesn't go full on down the chip route. It doesn't go full on down trance. It's like somewhere in the middle. It's a really nice. It's just a really well structured, nice sounding soundtrack, and there's quite a bit of it, as it turns out. There's more. There's quite a few decent songs in there. It's nice. Really like that. Like how it sounds. Like how it looks. It's got a really good style. I think I said before, like, I think I find the level design a little too annoying at times, rather more than fun. I think as I'm getting through to some of the, like, things are getting a little bit tougher, obviously. I'm getting through and I'm getting some new abilities. The levels are still throwing new mechanics at you or combining mechanics in interesting ways. But sometimes those are, they feel more annoying to pull off than they do fun to pull off. And I guess maybe that's just the bane of being a puzzle platformer. Maybe that's just how they are. To a certain extent, But I think there's things they could have done to make it like less annoying, like the targets for the level. Like I mentioned before, it's got a bunch of like quite hard targets to levels. There's not just get through the level. There's 100% the level, or use a certain number of platforms, which is your main trick to this game. You put platforms under your feet, but you can only do a certain number of those before you have to land on the ground again. And that's its main trick. But then eventually you get some of the platforms do things like shoot stuff below them and blah, 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 blah. And then you've got to use those to help you out. And some levels you get more platforms than others and things like that. But some of those other targets are like, yeah, use a certain number of platforms. And if you go more, you won't get that award. If you like, make sure you don't die, which is the other one I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do the 100% and the don't die. And the don't die is it's not so bad once, like, combining don't die and 100% is starting to prove a little bit tricky, especially on your first play of the level. So it's like, it's probably best to try and just do 100% run first and then just do a really quick, like, I don't care about collecting everything. I'm just going to go do a no death run because it's fine. That counts. You don't have to combine all of them together. I think the time trials, which I've attempted a couple of times, you can get, there's a time award for the levels as well. And those are hard. I've not been able to hit one of those yet. But you don't really have to. I think those are just sort of achievement hunting. I think those awards, as far as I can tell. The main thing is 100%ing the levels, because you need all the gubbins in the level to unlock other stuff between levels. But also the checkpoints are just miles too far apart at times. I think levels only have one checkpoint generally in them. And like your first playthrough for a level could take up to 10 minutes if you're trying to 100% it on the first run, and trying to figure out how you do things and trying to find where the secrets are. It's like, having only one checkpoint in the middle of the level means that if you do die, you're probably going to go back quite a long way and then just have to work your way back to where you were, which is mildly annoying. And enemies respawn when you die, and some switches reset when you die. So you do have to sort of play the room again rather than just so it can be a little irritating at time, but a little bit hardcore, maybe a little bit old school in some ways. And I think when I played at EGX, I really dug that. I dug the difficulty, but like, I don't know, maybe that was just the excitement of playing it for the first time and just kind of getting in the zone with the music and stuff like that. Maybe that first experience was just like, yeah, this is cool. I like what it's doing here. And then as I'm playing more of the game, it's just like, no, this is actually just grating on me a bit. Maybe that's the busy dad syndrome.
Do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. But I still think it's cool. It's just, it's definitely got good style. It's got style.
Sweet.
And some good ideas, but not necessarily perfect execution, which is pretty much the same opinion I have about doing the Dark Ages.
Oh.
Because...
How's it coming?
Yeah, I really flip-flop on it. Like, I go from like, yeah, that was fun. That was pretty cool. Oh, this is going really well. This feels rad, to, oh my God, I fucking hate this game.
Oh, wow.
Like, it goes on to extremes to me. Like, it's, it can just be, okay, yeah, as I said the good before, I like a lot of the weapons tend to just be machine gunny kind of things, but like with various perks to them that make them behave slightly differently. Like some have real, like the skull crusher that I think they showed in a lot of their early videos has a really wide horizontal spread to its shots, and the more things you kill with it, like you eventually get perks where it charges up the more you're using it, and then like when it charges, it reaches a certain level, the skulls all glow yellow. And then you start moving really quickly so you can like dance around the battlefield for a while. But it encourages you have to then like hold that gun out and be using just that gun. And a lot of the guns are like that, as it turns out. They do different things, they have different perks, but they kind of perform better if you stick to them rather than trying to switch out to other weapons a lot, which I think was more of a strategy in the previous Doom games. Like switching your weapons frequently was more of a more of a tactic there, whereas here it's a little bit more viable to keep to stick with a gun for a fight, which is just as well, because I really don't like the weapon switching in there.
Like,
it's a little thing, but like switching between weapons feels like it takes far too long to swap to a different gun. And it's somewhat compounded by the fact that there's like six weapon slots, but each one of those slots can have two different guns in them. So like your shotguns are on one if you're playing on a keyboard, right? So like it makes it kind of easy to switch between your weapon types, but it remembers what gun you were last using within that type. So for me, out of the plasma rifles, I'm always using the cycler. So if I push three, I know I'm going to get my cycler. I don't care about the other one. That's fine. With the shotguns, I tend to swap between the regular combat shotgun and the super shotgun. But
what makes it worth switching shotguns then?
Because they have different skills, right? The super shotgun is much shorter range, but does hella damage. Whereas the combat shotgun can be a bit further ranged. And it will set stuff on fire, and setting stuff on fire gets you armor. So there might be circumstances where it's like, okay, no, I want to farm for armor right now, so I want to use the regular shotgun for a bit and try and live a bit longer. Same with the other guns. They all have different perks, and the way they work together you might want to use a different gun based on the enemies you're fighting and what you need at that moment in time. You eventually get something that's a bit like a minigun, for instance, and when it spins up to full speed, like it's giving you tiny bits of health with the hits when it's charged up, when it's running at full speed, so it can be useful to refuel your... Or the rocket launcher, for instance. There's a nice classic rocket launcher that feels big and meaty, and but it does splash damage to you. So you can eventually get a perk where if you parry the green attacks from the enemies with your shield... that splash damage heals you instead of hurts you for a while. It's kind of cool. The ideas here are pretty good. But I think sometimes my biggest problem with the game is just how you see and adapt to everything that's going on. So for instance, in that example of the rocket launcher, like it goes into like this vampiric mode, I suppose, where instead of staying at a distance and firing the rockets, you want to be right up in their face. So you're healing off your own damage. But when I don't know what the indicator on screen is that tells me that that status stopped. So I suddenly go from healing myself to killing myself in an instant. And it's like, okay, that's annoying. I haven't quite figured that out. Some of the other guns have slightly more obvious like tells that when they're in their charged up state or not. And I think there is a little indicator on screen for some of them, like right under the crosshair, but it is tiny, like this teeny tiny little blue bar that shows you the charge level. I mentioned that before. I sort of kind of had a problem with that, right, with the shield health. I think I mentioned last time, because that's the same thing. Your shield can run out of juice, and then you're without a shield for a while, which is a bit of a problem in a game where there's like stuff coming at you from every angle. I don't know that the game necessarily like lands its whole stand and fight mantra, because like if you do try and stand and fight things, something's going to spawn behind you. And just slap you in the face. And I'm playing on essentially what is hard mode. So like it's not the what you'd call the normal. I think it's called ultra violence in this. I forget what the Doom terminology is.
Very Lana Del Rey. Okay.
Yeah. It's not nightmare mode. I think it's the one below nightmare mode. So I think I'm on ultra violence. And then there's pandemonium and ultra nightmare, which sound absolutely friggin' insane. I don't know if you can even attempt those, you're a madman.
I say Lana Del Rey, but it's really Clockwork Orange, isn't it?
What, ultra violence?
Yeah, it's more Anthony Burgess.
Yeah, I guess.
Not Zachary Burgess, though.
No, not Zachary.
That's another level.
So I kind of find like if I want to try and focus my fire and stand and fight a big guy, I can't really do that because I've still got to be looking around all the time at what else is happening, what else is going on. And in the difficulty level I'm on, it doubles You can see what the difficulty settings do, and there's like you can even like craft your own difficulty levels.
Oh, really?
It's like it's really like flexible in terms of like, oh, you want the parry window to be bigger? Sure, change it.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, you want the enemy aggression to be lower? Sure, change it. You want like the damage they do? Turn it down. Yeah, you can. It's really tunable if you want. But I'm playing on you know their recommended ultra violent setting. And yeah, I just find it quite annoying at times. Like certain combinations of enemies are just incredibly difficult to deal with because it's like, this guy is really big and I need to deal with him, but there's like a billion other things happening around me and I can die in an instant because everything does so much freaking damage. It's really hard. At times it's incredibly hard. But then sometimes you get in this zen-like state and you're just mowing everything down in your path and it feels fantastic. Like, I there's almost no middle ground. Like, it either feels brilliant or you're having an incredibly difficult time with it.
Yeah, frustrating, kind of.
And I think that's probably was true of the previous games as well, but I think I ended up finding my flow with them. Which I just, I'm over halfway through this. It's a big game as well, I should point that out. This is a pretty long game. And I'm just not 100% sure I'm finding my consistent flow, a consistent tactic.
Mm.
Like Doom Eternal and Shadow Warrior 3, of all things, kind of had the same flow to them. The whole thing was just keep doing laps, keep moving, keep flying as much as you can, shoot stuff as you go past it. Yeah,
defined against that.
Yeah. Exactly. This was like, yeah, no, we want you to be in the fight. And it's like, I feel like there's just too much going on to do that or to manage it successfully. I have other major, bigger problems with some of the mechanics as well. Like the parry system sometimes feels wrong. Like it's possible to take damage from the attack and still parry it sometimes. And whenever that happens, it's just like, what the bloody hell? Like, did I do that right or not? Like, make up your mind game. I hate that. I really hate that. maybe I've been hit by something else. I can't tell. And I just find that really irritating. Because there's a bigger melee focus in this as well. Like I feel like some of the hitboxes for some of the melee attacks just feel off. Like, you know, there's a Lionel-like thing.
Of course.
At one point, and he has a sort of shoulder budge. He sort of swings his shield and his sword follows it. And it feels like where that shield... I guess the shield is a damaging element of that attack, but it feels much bigger than it looks. Like, where it hits feels way bigger than it looks. So half the time it feels like you've been killed by it before the sword... It kind of feels like you're about to be hit by the sword that hasn't even landed yet.
I see.
And that just feels wrong. It just feels off. But then it looks amazing. Like, it really... Like, the id Tech... I mean, yes, everything's brown. Because the medieval,
it's Doom,
right?
Yeah, medieval Doom, yeah.
But it looks really nice, and it runs really nice. I'm running it pretty much on nightmare settings, not ultra nightmare, but like very high settings and it's still running incredibly on a 5070. Yes, okay, it's a high end card, I get it, but it's like it's not the highest end of cards, and it's I'm getting over 100 frames easy, sometimes pushing my monitor's 165 limit. For long spells, it runs great. It's a weird game. In all honesty, yeah, I'm torn about it, ripped, if you will,
like Natalie and Bruno.
That's pretty much all I've been doing. Yeah, I think that's the major. I'm sure I've forgotten something as always, but that's the bulk of where I've been.
Nice. Doom.
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 He says something. Spoilers. He says something. That's one point.
Wow. Amazing. I mean, yeah, it's taken this long and this much pivoting into doing full-blown story and cutscenes to the point where he actually said something. Wow. Imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I haven't even mentioned the narrative, but it's like it's there. There's not a lot to it, which is fine.
Yeah.
It occasionally makes absolutely no sense. Like, it's like, I don't get how we transferred from here to here as part of that chapter. I guess you just learnt something somewhere and now we're doing this. All right, fine, whatever. Some of the level design is kind of cool. I think the levels are too long. Generally, I think the level structures are often a bit too long. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, this has been the same thing with all three of the Doom games, I guess, is like you're referring to the map quite a lot. So it's a bit stop start. You moving around the world and then you go look at the map and it's like, are there any secrets nearby? Does this look like there's a path there? Because the map's quite generous in terms of like showing you every possible route as long as you've been there, and it will highlight secrets as long as you've been fairly close to them. Which all the previous games have done, but it just means you're like popping in and out of the map all the time. That's been a thing in all of the Doom games, all of the modern Dooms. So they haven't changed it here. But it'd be nice if they didn't in some ways. It'd be nice if it wasn't so much of an emphasis on the secrets and making sure you find all the gold and the rubies to upgrade your guns, or shield abilities or all that kind of stuff. It's like, but you kind of have to do that. You need that stuff. You need to upgrade yourself and the guns. Anyway, sorry. I should start talking.
I'm sure we'll hear some more about Doom.
Oh, yeah.
And others in our next podcast. But while you're waiting for that, we have a YouTube channel. So you should check that out. It's Happy Salad. What's the latest thing on there?
What is the latest thing up there? It's probably still thing. Against the Storm, right? That's probably the last thing we did.
Yeah, so if you're intrigued by Zach's tales of being of impatient queens, etc., and rain punk, it's not hyperfunk rain punk, but it's on its way.
Well, that would be a crossover.
Sorry, I just invented a game that doesn't exist. But I mean, if you want Against the Storm, it's on YouTube and many other games besides that we have played, including many anti-grav games at the moment. So check those out.
But the next one isn't an anti-grav game.
No. What's the next one?
Jazz Jackrabbit 2.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Technically, you could say right at the end, it kind of was an anti-gravity game.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler.
Watch the video to find out why.
Oh, yeah, indeed. What a note to finish on.
Yeah. Check that out. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another one of these Saladcasts. So we'll catch you then. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.